Hi, I'm Una Chaplin, and I'm the host of a new podcast called Hollywood Exiles. It tells the story of how my grandfather, Charlie Chaplin, and many others were caught up in a campaign to root out communism in Hollywood. It's a story of glamour and scandal and political intrigue and a battle for the soul of a nation. Hollywood Exiles from CBC Podcasts and the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Trumpists believe that the golden age of white manhood was from 1945 to the 1960s. They say they want to make America great again.
Welcome to Ideas. I'm Nahla Ayed.
But Trumpists also want to make America manly again. The only thing about that is that the acronym for Make America Manly Again is MAMA. I think we as a culture have lost our ability to distinguish between this is happening to me and this is a cosmic injustice.
21st century masculinity has come fraught with doubt and distress.
There's really a lot of evidence that many men are suffering. Depression rates are very high. And we used to think that depression was a female malady, right? Because it's anger turned inward. Many boys are adrift, addictions, and et cetera. And I mean, your hearts go out to men, of course. So there's a lot of evidence that men are not doing great.
In several Western countries, many men are working far less than before.
Whether it's wealthy businessmen who are struggling in a global economy, or whether it's a guy whose job has been shipped overseas and there's nothing left in his town, and the globalized modern world makes things hard culturally, mentally, economically for people who are worried about their manhood and who don't see much of a future for themselves in it.
Let the Democratic Party and the Chi-Com corrupted politicians and the mainstream media.
One response to the distress that some men are feeling is to reassert traditional masculinity, especially online.
I think that what these kind of far-right and alt-right online influencers and personas are doing are tapping into real, lived, and embodied psychological pain that men are feeling. But instead of trying to explain that pain in relation to, say, the history of patriarchy, of capitalism, they'll go on to say that the reason you're in pain, it's actually because of women. It's because women have got ahead. Feminists and liberals and other sort of bogeymen and so on.
But writer and educator Michael Kaufman sees another way forward in fatherhood.
This transformation of fatherhood is most powerful in terms of potential and most powerful in terms of what is actually happening right now in Canada, in the United States, across Europe, and increasingly in Asia, Africa, and Latin America. I really believe that this transformation of fatherhood will be to men what the feminist movement has been for women.
This is contributor Mary O'Connell's final episode in her three-part series, Man Up, The Masculinity Crisis.
In the final months of the 20th century, one Hollywood film pondered the dark recesses of masculinity, 1999's Fight Club.
The first rule of Fight Club is, you do not talk about Fight Club. The second rule of Fight Club is, you do not talk about Fight Club. Third rule of Fight Club.
Fight Club is the story of alienated young men who are fed up with desk jobs, gym memberships, and IKEA catalogs. They are victims of capitalism but they pursue authenticity by beating each other up in dungeon-like rooms.
Fights will go on as long as they have to.
This is crazy. You want me to hit you?
That's right.
What, like in the face?
Surprise me.
This is so fucking stupid. Motherfucker! You hit me in the ear! Well, Jesus, I'm sorry.
Ow! Oh, that was perfect.
Fight Club didn't do well at the box office initially, but it's since gained a cult following. Men should reject their roles in late-stage capitalism, and violence will help. That's the nihilistic message Brad Pitt's alpha male character sends to a frustrated office worker played by Ed Norton. In thousands of postings online, male fans embrace lines from Fight Club. Lines like this.
Man, I see in Fight Club the strongest and smartest men who've ever lived. I see all this potential and I see it squandered. God damn it, an entire generation pumping gas, waiting tables, slaves with white collars. Advertising has us chasing cars and clothes, working jobs we hate so we can buy shit we don't need. We're the middle children of history, man. No purpose or place. We have no great war, no great depression. Our great war is a spiritual war. Our great depression is our lives. We've all been raised on television to believe that one day we'd all be millionaires and movie gods and rock stars. But we won't. We're slowly learning that fact. And we're very, very pissed off.
But Ricky was a god for 10 minutes when he trounced the maitre d' of a local food court.
Fight clubs have proliferated, especially on university campuses. In a recent fight in the U.S., the student died from his injuries. Michael Kimmel is a sociologist and the author of Guyland.
Fight Club was really interesting. And the idea of Fight Club was not about hitting.
Sometimes all you could hear were the flat, hard, packing sounds over the yelling.
The thing that was so interesting to me when I talked to guys who were in fight clubs or heard of them or been involved in them in some way, consistently what they said was it was about being hit. It was about feeling something. You know, the critique in Fight Club in the book and in the movie is you work in a box, you live in a box, you commute to work in a box, you're completely cushioned, it's completely surrounded by cotton, you feel nothing in a relationship, you feel nothing. You gotta feel something. So I'm gonna feel pain. And I want you to hit me.
But Fight Club only exists in the hours between when Fight Club starts and when Fight Club ends. Even if I could tell someone they had a good fight, I wouldn't be talking to the same man. Who you were in Fight Club is not who you were in the rest of the world. A guy came to Fight Club for the first time, his ass was a wad of cookie dough. After a few weeks, he was carved out of wood.
You can fight any celebrity.
You know, the Silicon Valley guys, they're coding all day and they're, you know, absolutely just brain work. And so they would have these garage fight clubs and they take the keyboard with the string, you know, the cord, they'd wrap the keyboard in a pillowcase and tie it, and then they'd swing it around and hit each other with the keyboards.
God, what a visual.
I know, right? And they capture our imagination because they capture something of the moment of men searching for something that's going to make them feel good about being men. You know, we do live in a culture in which pretty much every day there's a kind of steady litany of men behaving badly and men are bad, and add race to that and white men are just, you know, nowhere to go and nothing, you have nothing to say and you're the oppressor. And these guys are feeling like, well, what about me? I'm just a regular guy, you know, and there'll be gurus like Peterson or Sachs or Michael Gurion who come along and say, men need to do this. And, you know, what is Jordan Peterson? Sit up straight. Sit up straight. Take charge of your life. You know, stop sitting around moping. Jordan Peterson is for, in the sort of cultural psychology world, what everything I needed to know I learned in kindergarten is. He has his own stuff with feminism and multiculturalism, but that's not bad advice, really.
Women know what they have to do. Men have to figure out what they have to do.
There's a crowded field of experts on the subject of what ails men today. Canadian psychologist Jordan Peterson is one of them. He believes society is partly to blame for the masculinity crisis because it basically stereotypes males as being bad.
That's another thing that we're doing to men that's a very bad idea, and to boys. It's like, you're pathological and oppressive. It's like, fine then, why the hell am I going to play? If that's the situation, if I get no credit for bearing responsibility, you could bloody well be sure I'm not going to bear any. But then, you know, your life is useless and meaningless, and you're full of self-contempt and nihilism, and that's not good. That's what I think's going on at a deeper level with regards to men needing this direction. A man has to decide that he's going to do something. He has to decide that.
But just what is it that men must decide to do? It is an old question. In the late 1800s, men and boys were viewed as nervous, weak, and distressed as the Industrial Revolution took increasing hold of towns and cities. Today, there's another masculinity crisis, and again, social scientists are debating why. Richard V. Reeves says men now face the prospect of cultural redundancy. In America, men are now employed at the same rate as in 1940, after the Great Depression. A Brookings Institute scholar, Richard V. Reeves, is the author of Boys and Men, Why Men Are Struggling, Why It Matters, and What to Do About It.
Traditionally, male jobs have declined precipitously over the last 40, 50 years. And this is obvious: manufacturing, heavy industry, etc. And men haven't, by and large, moved into some of the growing occupations which are more female-dominated, such as in health and education, at all. And so they're somewhat stuck between the labor market of their dad and the labor market of their wife. And haven't managed to kind of make that adjustment back through. It's not helped when politicians come along and promise to wave a magic wand and bring back the labor market of the 50s. So the result of that is quite a bit of detachment from men. But by and large, they're not coming out of the labor. I wish I could say they were coming out of the labor market to care for kids and care for others. They're by and large not. By and large, it's not clear exactly what a lot of them are doing when they're out of the labor market. But it's not, unlike for women, when women aren't in the labor market, it's usually because they're doing something else. With men, it's not clear what they're doing. And I think there we have to ask ourselves hard questions about the role of men and the role of men in the family. I think that the danger is of making men feel benched if they can't fulfill the traditional breadwinner role. That reduces their incentive to go into the labor market. I'm sure that's part of the story.
Some economists point to other reasons American men are dropping out of the labor market. More of them are on disability, often after serving in the military, and drug addiction, especially the use of opioids, has knocked a vast number of men out of the workplace.
I'm a hard-working man. I wear a steel hard hat. I can ride rope, a hammer and paint, do things with my hands that most men can't. I can't get ahead no matter how hard I try. I'm getting really good at barely getting by.
Richard V. Reeves resists portraying men as simply victims. He believes affirmative action programs that encourage men to enter female-dominated professions like nursing and teaching is one viable strategy. But he adds further study on why men are falling behind is needed because, quote, it's not that men have fewer opportunities, it's that they're not taking them, end quote. This idea that men are solely victims at the mercy of a brutal economy and government that punishes manhood was a reoccurring theme in Michael Kimmel's book, Angry White Men, published in 2013. 3 years before the election of Donald Trump.
The name Trump does not appear in the book. So in many ways, I feel like I wrote a book about his followers who were waiting for the leader to show up. Now, let me say, when I would approach these guys, and so gun shows appear You Canadians have no idea, you know. So suburban schools are perpetually starving for funds. What they often do is they rent out their gyms or their lunchrooms to traveling gun shows that set up in the gym and sell guns. Walk out with an assault weapon by just putting $600 or $1,200 on a table. Outside the gun show are these tables where these political groups are leafleting. The guys I was interested in were the guys with the leaflets. So I would go up to them at the table and I would say, I'm a researcher, I'm a sociologist. And I would say very honestly, like, look, I'm not going to convince you of my ideas. We're so different. But my job is to try to understand how you see the world. Now, I would say about a third of the men wanted nothing to do with me at all. I don't want to talk to you. I think only once was I ever physically like, you know, you better get out of here. And then I made a deal with them that I would interview them in a public place during the day. I never went to a meeting. I never went visited them at night, only one-on-one. So first time, very first interview, guy walks in, he's wearing a flannel shirt, old baseball hat, and he opens up his shirt to show me that he's wearing a t-shirt with a Confederate flag on it. And he says, I wore this just for you. I said, okay, great. And so I took out my tape recorder. I put it down on the table. He said, oh, I can't talk to you. I said, why not? He said, you must be FBI.
Many of the men Michael Kimmel interviewed were pro-capitalist, yet despised corporations. They hated the government, but were extremely patriotic. They wanted to be heroes, but saw themselves as victims. This contradictory or paradoxical pattern was telling. Michael Kimmel describes them as the shock troops for Donald Trump.
I think the group that I'm talking about, downwardly mobile, lower middle class, these were guys whose father, grandfather owned small farms, owned small shops. Some of them were, you know, non-union carpenters, contractors, roofers, painters, etc. So they were downwardly mobile in the sense that they didn't really control their own labor. Now, the lower middle class has always been the kind of mobilizable group for either progressive politics in the Basque Country, in Russia in 1917, or the shock troops for the right-wing populist resurgence. Think Argentina under Perón. Think the Italian fascists were entirely lower middle class. The other thing that I think is important about the downwardly mobile lower middle class is like most men, they have a certain sense of entitlement. I'm supposed to have respect, dignity in my work. And if I'm not getting it, I am enraged. So the term that I use to describe them is aggrieved entitlement. They believe they're entitled to something and it's being thwarted. Now the question is, who's thwarting it? Is it in fact people of color who cause climate change? Is it feminist women who outsourced your job? No, of course not. I believe that they are right to be angry. I think they have been given a bad deal, but I also think they're delivering their mail to the wrong address.
Michael Kimmel's book was published 10 years ago. He says he would not write about angry men today because the atmosphere has grown so much more polarized and violent.
The Chi-Com corrupted politicians and the mainstream media.
Yeah. 21st century masculinity took a dramatic turn with the emergence of the Manosphere, a loose collection of online communities from neo-Nazi groups to anti-feminist men. There are incels who promote violence against women who won't date them, to MGTOW, men going their own way, a male separatism movement. The term manosphere was popularized in 2009 by a pornography marketer, and the angry male victim message has thrived online ever since. It's a subject PhD candidate Jillian Sunderland is exploring.
Like, you can be sending Twitter messages all day and meet like-minded people. So it is very exciting to be part of this new cultural shift that is always in the news, always provoking a reaction. They're part of almost this great reset, redefining masculinity. Tucker Carlson's video, I don't know if you've seen it, but it's called The End of Men.
Author C.S. Lewis warned of a West that one day would be filled with what he called men without chests. And we see that prophecy coming true today. We call them, less poetically, man boobs. They're a physical manifestation of something bigger. The decline of manhood, of virility, of physical health, all of which together threaten to doom our civilization. Testosterone levels in American men are declining by about 10% per decade, 1% a year. Sperm counts have plummeted 50% in the last 40 years.
He talks about that men have been taught to kind of be too feminine, be too restrained. And he wants to be one of these vanguards who shows men back to this true masculinity, like it looks to be almost a hero's tale.
For decades, the far right was analyzed primarily from a racial or political perspective. But academics have recently begun applying a gendered lens. Jillian Sunderland wondered, what do these groups tell us about masculinity? Jillian Sunderland has noticed that many far right websites make reference to the 1999 movie, The Matrix. The cyber thriller tells the story of men who are mired in existential malaise until they're invited to take the red pill to wake up.
Even now, in this very room, you can see it when you look out your window or when you turn on your television. You can feel it when you go to work, when you go to church, when you pay your taxes. It is the world that has been pulled over your eyes to blind you from the truth.
What truth?
So the red pill is something that's talked about a lot in a lot of extremist communities. So the red pill in the Matrix movie, Neo, the kind of main character, and Morpheus, this spiritual or kind of this guide figure for him, he offers him the choice between a blue pill and a red pill. And the blue pill means that he can go back to this fantasized society, this fake society, but he's happy, everything's good. It's an illusion. Now the red pill, he can wake up to the truth of the society, see things how things actually are. Now in the movie, it is very disturbing. So when people talk about the red pill, they talk about, I used to think, or I was told when I was growing up, everyone's equal, that women weren't as important as men. You know, those pictures with all the multicolored hands holding hands. I was told that that was a great thing. But now I've taken the red pill and realized I'm a man. I'm a white man. I'm better than racialized people. I'm better than women. This is the natural order of things. We as a society has been brainwashed against the natural order of things. It's a point of where they become fully radicalized, where they realize all this equality discourse is nonsense. Now I've fully come to the realization that I'm actually superior, and this is the way that society should be.
Remember, all I'm offering is the truth, nothing more.
I guess so then people interpret the blue pill, it keeps men happily oblivious to the fact that they are society's slaves, and then the red pill takes men down the rabbit hole, right? That feminism has oppressed them in the sense that women run the world and male victims are not allowed to complain.
Yeah. So what's interesting on Twitter is that Elon Musk talked about the red pill, that he had taken it. And Ivanka Trump replied that she had taken it too, like taken the red pill.
Mm-hmm.
You're listening to Ideas on CBC Radio 1 in Canada, across North America on Sirius XM, in Australia on ABC Radio National, and around the world at cbc.ca/ideas. You can also hear Ideas on the CBC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Nala Ayed.
When faced with the complex moral questions the world tends to throw our way, it's easy to feel overwhelmed. My name is Waleed Ali.
And I'm Scott Stevens. We're the hosts of The Minefield, an ABC Australia podcast.
And each week we try to navigate the moral complexities of modern life in a way that's unexpected, unpredictable, intellectually serious, but more than a little fun.
Along the way, we're joined by a range of philosophers and thinkers who promise to help you see the world and the challenges we face in a different light.
You can listen to The Minefield wherever you get your podcasts.
Much of the men's movement today has moved online. Far-right groups are leveraging that fact to their advantage and creating micro-communities.
I always imagine sort of the person who is standing in a subway station here in New York at 2:30 in the morning, screaming at the walls, you know, about whatever conspiracy. Now they go on the internet and they find someone who agrees with them. Yes, nobody's listening to them at the subway. But now, so yeah, that's a good point. And suddenly they feel like, oh my God, I have an audience. So I think that these people are looking for community. And what is the community? It's a community of the validation of their manhood.
This is the third episode of a three-part series called Man Up, The Masculinity Crisis by Ideas contributor Mary O'Connell. Guardian journalist, author, and podcaster Brian Rafferty analyzed a popular website called The Red Pill, a website that mostly solicits stories from angry young men about being red-pilled. Brian Rafferty believes The Red Pill poses a conundrum for the times. Are we our real selves on the internet, or are we something or someone else? This is a reading of what he concluded after his online analysis.
I saw mostly feral boys wandering the digital ruins of exploded masculinity, howling their misery, concocting vast nonsense about women, and craving the tiniest crumb of self-confidence and fellow feeling. The discussion threads are a mixed bag of rage and curiosity. Screeds against feminists, advice on how to masturbate less, theories on why women fantasize about rape, descriptions of arguments with girlfriends, and most of all, workout schedules and diet regimes.
But how do we assess how dangerous misogynistic online ideas really are? Is this kind of masculinity just ramped up locker room talk? Is it megaphone misogyny? Or is it the canary in the coal mine? Jillian Sunderland.
So you could have a young 18-year-old guy watches some YouTube videos, say of like a far-right figure that's popular, goes on an internet in his downtime, but regularly goes to school, does well, has friends. So would we consider him a part of the movement? Well, he's definitely consuming and engaging, but maybe it's not to the same extent of some people who make it their life. But I would say that those people who aren't as invested, they still contribute to our culture where we're seeing more vitriol. They're still retweeting maybe hashtags that are very misogynistic.
And they may be absorbing something that maybe they're not even aware of.
Yeah. And it's very easy to get drawn into kind of very extremist rhetoric very, very quickly. So it may start off as just fun. The recent person that was recruiting young men was Andrew Tate.
If you give a man true free rein, completely be who you want to be, and you don't let society program you, he's going to drive a fast car, he's going to have a bunch of women, he's going to want to have a bunch of money, he's going to do whatever he wants, right? Men and women are not the same. We've never been the same. This new think idea that men and women are the same is complete garbage that's been invented, right?
So a lot of young boys, as young as 13 and 14, were just on YouTube, were just watching different TikToks on Twitter, but it kind of feeds into itself, where the more you consume, the more you want to consume, and algorithms are kind of pushing you into these more extremist things. So maybe it starts off as kind of just an innocent little thing, but there's a lot of people who get really, really drawn into these things, and it begins to change their perspective.
If a woman sleeps with multiple people, that's cheating. That's absolutely unacceptable on every level. If I have a woman who I truly love, and I go out and I come back to her, and I don't care about her, and I only love my girl, that's not cheating. That's exercise. If she even talks to a dude, it's cheating. Because females are emotionally invested. I have no emotional investment.
Andrew Tate has been accused of rape and human trafficking. He remains under house arrest after being released to England by Romanian authorities. Senior police figures and rights campaigners believe Tate promotes a pernicious rape culture. But why does he hold such appeal? For a number of reasons, say observers. Men who can't handle their anxiety, anger, and pain look to influencers like Tate for entertainment, distraction, guidance, or support for their misogyny. But for Tate, it's a cash cow.
Literally, as part of their business model, produce and sell quite patriarchal, misogynistic content under the guise and camouflage of self-help to men that are searching for answers to why their conditions are the way they are, which do reflect a sense of entitlement.
Tanner Merlies is an associate professor of communication and digital media studies at Ontario Tech University.
Andrew Tate and others will capitalize on that anxiety, turn it into a form of resentment, feeding into that by selling online courses, by selling sort of self-help. So I mean, Andrew Tate was a mixed martial artist and also appeared on a reality TV show for a season, and then sort of parlayed that modest celebrity into online courses on behalf of men's rights. So this Andrew Tate figure is sort of the latest manifestation of a grifter, of an entrepreneur, of an online influencer to make millions of dollars. And this person is worth over $300 million and takes about $2 million annually. So
wait a minute. What do you mean? He's worth $300 million?
$300 million is the net worth for all of this sort of work that he's been doing. It's a racket. So ultimately, these far-right men's groups are the greatest enemy of men, in my opinion. Quite exploitative as well, because we have to remember a lot of these right-wing influencers are capitalizing, literally, on men that probably don't have a lot of money to begin with. You know, and if these men perhaps were more affluent or had more secure, stable jobs or had a sense of meaning in life, the fact is that a lot of these men are struggling economically. They're struggling psychologically, and they are being, I think, taken advantage of. And that's not only about the power of the right, but it also, I think, reflects a failure of the left to get its message across and its diagnosis of the symptom and the source of that ailment or that illness, you know? So the first use of masculinity by the far right is about identity making. All far right movements are identities, you know, and we often would talk about like identity politics as being like a liberal or left wing thing, but identity politics is rampant, you know, it's full fledged on the right.
There are many battles raging amongst keyboard warriors presenting their various versions of masculinity. Some groups like Stormfront are made up mostly of older white men who believe women, as mothers, must be protected and cared for, and black men threaten their nest, and ultimately the white ethno-state. Other groups tear this version apart, saying women should never be trusted because they are a subspecies who will lie, cheat, and drain your bank account. Some have said these fractious battles represent the dying gasp of patriarchy.
It's part and parcel of the modern era feminism, an attack on masculinity. Masculinity has been portrayed as the problem.
Feminist scholar Judith Butler says there's something performative about all this megaphone misogyny. In fact, Butler believes all gender identities are, in a sense, a performance, a social construct that we live and play out, for better or worse. And some men, who see themselves as patriarchy's children, playing a role, act out the power they've been given.
Masculinity, male power, is the reason there are so many wars. Male power is the reason so many people get hurt. Male power is why women and children are not safe in marriage. Male power equals predatory behavior. All of this was either stated directly or an undercurrent of modern feminism.
In his online blog, masculinity scholar Anthony Rotundo points to Rush Limbaugh as a good example of this gender performance.
Limbaugh was like the school kid who breaks all the rules and defies the teacher. So he's the best known kid in the class, a constant focus of attention. His classmates are transfixed by his transgression. Transgression transfixes. This bad boy model follows us into adulthood, and that was the source of Limbaugh's appeal. He wasn't a traditional free market conservative. He was a conservative who wanted to keep things the way they were when he was a kid, with white guys on top. He broke all the new rules of political etiquette. His fans explained their loyalty to him by saying, he says what he thinks. But what his fans really meant was, he says what I think, but don't dare say. So Rush Limbaugh turned the Republican Party more into the party of plain white folk and less the party of Wall Street. His was the language of the middle school playground, and he turned it into a language of public discourse. He turned open cruelty into public entertainment. In 1994, the Republicans completed the Reagan Revolution by taking control of Congress for the first time in half a century. The media called 1994 the year of the angry white male and named Limbaugh as one of its prime movers. Rush Limbaugh helped set the stage for Donald Trump and the politics of style, of destruction, and especially of anger. After all, anger is the only emotion that men are allowed to express without tarnishing their masculinity.
While men's rights groups in both the political and social spheres have occupied much cultural space over the past two decades, the work of feminist men has often flown under the radar. That's one reason sociologist Michael Kimmel created the Center for the Study of Men and Masculinities at Stony Brook University in 2013, the first center of its kind in North America.
Women's studies gave us a sense that gender was a really important organizing principle of social life, historically, culturally, politically, and apply that to men. You know, here's a really great example. Take a course on 19th century British lit. You study the Brontes, you study Jane Austen. It's all about femininity, about what does it mean to be a modern woman, owning property, not owning, you have to marry for it, you know, all these dilemmas that women have to sort out. In the same course, you would read Dickens. And what would you talk about? You'd talk about class. No one ever talked about fatherhood in Dickens, masculinity. But his biggest novels, his longest novels, are about young boys looking for an authentic father figure. David Copperfield, Oliver Twist, Pip. I mean, let's talk about Dickens and fatherhood. That's what masculinity studies did. You know, I founded a journal about masculinities, and I tried to clear some field within gender studies to try and carve out an area that we could talk about men using the same tools, feminist theory, queer theory, multicultural theory. I thought it was actually just following the lead of what these women's studies scholars had done. Because if you can't just gender one group.
I think it's kind of a mistake to not study whiteness, to not study heterosexuality, to not study masculinity, because by only studying the marginalized, you leave the center unexamined. And that's how the center stays the center. Nobody criticizes it. Nobody examines it. So part of masculinity studies is decentering the center, as it was, the unexamined center. If everybody else has talked about and you're not, you're the one in power.
It's a story about, this was many, many years ago in the 80s, and I had taken a walk in Hyde Park here in Toronto, and it was a beautiful autumn day. The trees were orange and red and yellow, and the sky was blue, and it just felt good to be alive.
Michael Kaufman is a Toronto-based writer and activist. His most recent book is called The Time Has Come, Why Men Must Join the Gender Equality Revolution.
And I was still just floating the next day when I ran into my friend Varda Burstyn. And I started going on poetically about the trees and the sky. And as I went on, she just stared at me, you know, her arms crossed. And finally I said, Varda, what's wrong? And she said, I too took a walk in a park yesterday. And she said, but here's what happened to me. And she talked about how some man started following her as she turned this way and then that, you know, that way down one path and another. He didn't come close, but he didn't stop stalking her. And then she passed two men sitting on a park bench. They were chatting to each other, but as she got close, they stopped talking. They looked her up and down. One of them made some noise. And she said, Michael, that's the thing. You enjoy, as a man, forms of privilege that you don't even know you have. Privilege is invisible to those who have it. Now, I started apologizing to her, and she just interrupted me, and she said, Michael, did you do something to a woman yesterday? Did you do something to me yesterday that you're apologizing for? I said, no, but, and she said, Michael, stop. I don't want you to feel guilty for something you didn't do. I want you to feel angry. I want you to feel angry that a woman in your city doesn't have the same basic rights and privileges that you enjoy. So turn that, you know, that guilt is useless. Turn it into anger, turn it into concern, and use that to find power within that, to join women in continuing to take the action that you're taking.
Michael Kaufman took his friend's advice in the 1990s with the late NDP leader Jack Layton. They came up with the White Ribbon Campaign. It was a way for men to promote awareness of violence against women and the desire to end it. Eventually, the campaign went global. Nelson Mandela led a white ribbon march in South Africa. Schoolboys in Singapore organized marches. Bikers in New Zealand toured their country speaking out. And Brazilian revelers donned the ribbons at Mardi Gras, the country's most public event. Michael Kaufman says while many women supported the campaign, some responded, "What took you so long?" In her book, See What You Made Me Do, author and journalist Jess Hill tells us that men don't abuse women because society tells them it's okay. They do it because society tells them they're entitled to be in control. Michael Kimmel concurs. Think of a seesaw.
The feeling of power and the feeling of powerlessness, that many men feel powerless even though they have all the power. If you feel powerless, if you feel one down, violence is a way to restore the equality. It's not a way to subjugate someone from above, although it's that too. But it can also be a way to restore what should be your equality. So men, for example, tend to hit women at certain times and places when patriarchy, quote, breaks down. When she doesn't have dinner ready, when she doesn't want to have sex, that's when he hits her. Why? Because his power, he now feels powerless. I work all day, I come home, and you don't even have dinner ready for me? So he uses violence as a way to restore his sense of masculinity. You know, you want to start a fight on a playground anywhere in North America. You walk onto the playground where a bunch of 7-year-olds are happily playing, and you say, who's the sissy around here? Right? You can start a fight, right? Just like that. Oh, he is, no fight.
Well, then who the hell else are you talking? You talking to me?
That famous line in Taxi, are you talking to me?
Who the fuck do you think you're talking to? Oh, yeah?
You're putting me down? You're calling me that name? You're saying this about me? You know, you're calling me a woman, a girl, a pussy, a skirt, I'll show you I'm not. So violence then is restorative. You know, you put me down. I use violence to restore what should be there. So I think men's violence with women and with other men is very similar in that sense. It's about restoring that sense of manhood that has now been threatened.
Man, he says, you're being so PC. A guy can't be a guy anymore. Here we have a remarkable example of the backlash against feminism. You know, think of it. We've had the greatest affirmative action program for hiring that the world has ever seen. It's called patriarchy. For 8,000 years, we've hired only men. We've promoted only men. We've exalted only men. We've said that men are closer to God, and on and on and on.
Michael Kaufman speaks to audiences large and small about the contradictory lives of men. Many times a man will tell him, I have no power in my workplace. My wife bosses me around. Kaufman says that while individual lives differ, still men as a group enjoy privilege, opportunity, and safety that women do not. But he says patriarchy also exacts a price from men with its messages to stay on top, keep your life under control, just man up. Michael Kaufman's latest advocacy work and passion is fatherhood.
Think about it. The main quality you need, for example, to raise a child, particularly a young child, is empathy. Why? Because young kids can't speak. And even when they get a bit older, they can't adequately express what they're going through. And so you need empathy. Now, that is, in some cases, literally beaten out of boys as they've been traditionally raised. We learn to reduce our empathy, which is one of the causes of men's violence. And my colleagues in Equimundo...
Is that the Center for Masculinities and Social Justice?
Yeah. And my colleagues have done these huge surveys now around the world. And we're beginning to have the evidence that men who are more involved in childcare and equally involved are less likely to use violence in their relationships, or indeed other men. Another result is that men will be more in touch with each other, that intimacy that so many men miss, and I think deep down crave. And let me tell you how far this transformation is going. We are now seeing laws that promote that transformation. Canada, just a couple of years ago now, brought in laws that are based on what gets called the daddy quota. And it's an amazing change based on models that first developed in the Scandinavian countries. And what these models did was said this: parents should be able to share parental leave. In a home where there's two parents of whatever sex, the two parents should be able to equally share that.
Well, I do know that some countries, you know, have tried to encourage fatherhood. Germany was one. It found initially that men were simply transferring their paternity leave to their wives. And Germany had to say, look, you better stay at home with the kids or you'll be taxed or you'll lose the money somehow.
Yeah. I think it was policy was ahead of the realities that men faced. In some cases, it was the policies were ahead of the expectations of some men who just felt, well, this is really women's job. And the policies help encourage men to say, hey, it's my job too. But in other cases, men were up against biases in the workplace, the stigma against taking time off from work, particularly in professional jobs. So it was the pressure at work wanting to be seen as, you know, part of the team and not letting their coworkers down, lack of understanding from their supervisor about why they'd be taking time off, worried about getting ahead, worried about advance. And as well as, you know, I talked to men who who the pressures came from their parents, who, you know, when these men told their parents, I'm going to take 6 months off to look after our baby, you know, these parents would say, well, what are you going to do? So there's a lot of biases and pressures and assumptions. It's going to take a while for 8 or 10,000 years of patriarchy to come to an end. Well, we're seeing these changes all around us now, this transformation of fatherhood. And I think that what it's going to do is really fundamentally transform and challenge our gendered ideals of manhood, you know, just shake up the suit of armor that we're supposed to wear, what some have called the man box, and just say, you know, as men, we can embrace parts of our humanity that has been denied to us, is already having ripple effects throughout the whole society.
Oh, boy. Sentai. Yeah, you did? Aw. Tell me, what did you dream about? Did you dream about sheep? Yeah? Or bunnies? Was it bunnies or sheep? Yeah? Tell me, Abel. Yeah, I know. Well, here is my son. He's 7 weeks old, and one of my favorite things to do with him is talk to him. I speak to Helier in a mixture of English and Somali. Did you have a good nap? Was it good? Yeah? When I look at him here in his nursery in our home in Nairobi, Kenya, sometimes I am astonished that he's actually here. Wehelie is the result of many years of hoping for his presence in the world.
And then what else? What else?
Hassan Santour is a novelist and writer who emigrated to Canada from Somalia when he was young. He now lives in Nairobi, Kenya, with his wife and Wehelie, his son.
Yeah. That's right.
What does it mean to have a dad? And what happens when you grow up without one? How does one develop a sense of identity as a man? What is masculinity? What cues do you look for? And does it even matter? When I was a young boy, I used to love asking my mother about my father. He passed away when I was 4 years old. She would tell me stories about how sweet and gentle he was. Although I loved hearing these stories, I felt a pang of sadness, but I never expressed this longing for fear of hurting my mother's feelings. She had done such a wonderful job raising 7 kids on her own. Imagine.
Hi, Abo. Do you like that song, Abo? Yeah?
I didn't really think about my lack of a father figure in my life until we immigrated to Canada when I was a teenager. Growing up in Somalia, fathers were stern, emotionally distant figures who always seemed uncomfortable in the presence of children. Perhaps they were told that looking after children was not the work of men. But when we moved to Canada, I saw that fathers could be different, nurturing and loving. And that changed me. One of the things that has happened to me a lot since becoming a father is that I often think about my own father. It breaks my heart to know that my father will never see my son. But I find some consolation in my vision of heaven, a kind of humanist paradise. In the afterlife, God comes to me and says, "You see that man sitting under that huge tree? That's your father. He's been waiting for you. Go talk to him." And what would I say? Now that I am a father, I find myself thinking a lot about what kind of father I want to be. I have so many questions, but few answers. How can I protect my son without being overprotective? How do I love him deeply without suffocating him? How do I guide him, but also allow him to be whoever he was meant to be? How do I raise a good man?
Should we sing together? Yeah? You're going to be my backup singer? Yeah? Okay, let's sing together. Okay, Abba? Let's do a duet. Hoo-wah-ya-hoo-wah. Yeah, that's a good backup singer. Yeah. Hoo-wah-ya-hoo-wah.
On Ideas, you've been listening to the final episode of Man Up, The Masculinity Crisis, produced by Mary O'Connell. Thanks to Greg Kelly for several readings. Thanks also to Jean Dalrymple for providing archival material. And special thanks to the Conversations with Coleman podcast interview with Richard Reeves. Lisa Ayuso is the web producer for Ideas. Technical production, Danielle Duval. The senior producer is Nikola Lukšić. The executive producer of Ideas is Greg Kelly. And I'm Nala Ayed.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.